Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
All right, welcome to today's show. Others receiving votes. I'm Pat Forty, joined as usual by Gene Wojciechowski and Brian Fisher. If you're watching this, I apologize that I appear to be coming from like the Dragnet interrogation room. I'm in a hotel from built like in the 1920s in Los Angeles for the Rose Bowl. So you get what you get in terms of ambiance. Happy New Year, gentlemen. We're about done with 2025. Not a minute too soon. We'll get to some of the stupidity there. A couple other things here on today's show. We're going to go deep, obviously, on the quarterfinal games. A banger set of four games there. We'll sample some other bowls that we're interested in. We'll discuss Notre Dame keeping Marcus Freeman and Michigan landing Kyle Whittingham. We will brace for the opening of the transfer portal, which comes January 2nd, and recap a very dumb year in college sports. And speaking of dumb, we will chronicle the dangers of an Outback Steakhouse toilet. Get ready. But clearly we're going to start with the playoff. Great eight teams remain. Four matchups that should be outstanding, should stop the grumbling about the playoff games aren't good enough. The matchups for everybody, just to recap, New Year's Eve, Miami versus Ohio State in the Cotton Bowl. And then a triple header on New Year's Day, Texas Tech versus Oregon in the Orange Bowl, Alabama versus Indiana in the Rose, and Mississippi versus Georgia in the Sugar. So let's do a quick overview before we get to the game picks. Gino, I would like you to rank the four games in order of intrigue, and then we will follow off your genius.
I'm sorry, I'm having such difficulty. You look like a dream sequence with that lighting or something. It's hard to concentrate. I will rank them. I'm going to go from four to one, all right? Number four is okay. Miami, Ohio State. And let me just preface all this by saying I think all four games are really intriguing. And there's a very small margin of difference between the four to me. But Miami and Ohio State has the least amount of intrigue to me, if that's the right word. They do have the storyline of 2003 and the most debated pass interference call of all time. But more than that, I'm having a hard time coming up with something that really genuinely intrigues me. Number three, Ole Miss, Georgia. And this one intrigues me from a financial standpoint because Lane Kiffin, by doing absolutely nothing, has already made $400,000 in bonuses. And if Ole Miss were to win the national championship, he would win or earn, I guess, $2.65 million in bonuses because of the way his new LSU contract is structured. He's getting paid as if he were still at Ole Miss coaching. And I dug up some numbers, and if they did win it and he got that 2.65, that would be more than the combined salaries from this past year of Bob Chesney, Timmy Chang, and Jason Eck. So just from a financial standpoint, that is bizarre to me. And it's still going to be a really intriguing game. Two, Texas Tech, Oregon. From a football standpoint, fellas, I think this is absolutely the most intriguing game. A lot of X and O stuff going on here. That's a lot of fun and probably way above my pay grade, but I'm looking forward to that game. But number one to me, and take care, Pat, I don't want you to faint here, but Indiana, your guys, Indiana against Bama, to me is just absolutely the coolest game out there. At the Rose Bowl, Indiana, this team from nowhere 2 years ago against Alabama, the brand of all brands, but now the roles are reversed. So I'm really curious and really looking forward to seeing how that game unfolds.
Ryan, what do you got?
You know what? I'm going to put Ole Miss Georgia last in terms of entry, unless that is, we see Lane Kiffin on the sidelines there at the Sugar Bowl. I know he's pretty friendly with Kirby Smart, and he's got those text chains going, so maybe he can get a sideline pass there at the Sugar Bowl, but I've seen that game before. I was literally there in Athens watching that game. And so I think obviously the only thing that has changed between then and now is who the head coach is of the Rebels. And because this is an all SEC affair, and I've seen it before, I kind of put that one last. I will disagree with Gito. I would put Miami, Ohio State at the top in terms of entry. Obviously, you have a team going for really defending their national champion here in the Cotton Bowl, third straight time the Buckeyes have been here in Dallas. Against a Miami team that not only are they carrying that banner for the ACC, but like they over at Media Day yesterday, they really used that chip on the shoulder. You know, there's a lot of doubts about this Hurricanes team. Is the U back? That sort of thing. I think they go into this matchup pretty fired up and excited to be on this national stage. It's New Year's Eve. Going to be a big focus on this game. I think there's quite a bit of intrigue there around Miami and Ohio State. So I would put that number one. And then right behind it, I'm going to put Texas Tech and Oregon. You know, Novo Reich versus new money. You know, what a lot of talk about these rosters, how they were built, how these programs have been run. I think that's going to be not only a competitive game, but a pretty intriguing game against two teams that are, you know, kind of trying to break up the old boys club here in the college football playoff. And then I will follow that up there with the Rose Bowl with the caveat that it's supposedly going to be a little bit rainy there for you, Pat. So the sunset is not going to be there. So I think that kind of dampens the intrigue there for the Rose Bowl.
Not only is it going to rain, supposedly, but the sunset is now going to be at a different time.
Oh, yeah.
Because the kickoff is an hour earlier. And so, you know, the magical end of the third quarter sunset over the San Gabriels that has actually ruled the schedule of the college football playoff and the bowl system for its entire existence is thrown off. Incredible concession by the Rose Bowl, the Tournament of Roses. Again, these are one of these things where if you tell somebody from Europe, yeah, this is kind of how things work. We have to play these games at these times because the Rose Bowl has to have the sunset at the end of the third quarter. It was always a classic, like, you've got to be kidding me thing. But we're finally not going to have it at the end of the third quarter. So be prepared, everybody. Be prepared. My list probably hews a little closer to Gene's. I absolutely have the Rose Bowl number one. Just to me, the the collision of Indiana and Alabama in completely reversed roles, as Gene said, is endlessly fascinating to me. And I'll be interested. We'll see. This is early Tuesday morning. I'll see the Hoosiers here a little bit later and just kind of give them the look test, which you kind of like to do for teams at games at this stage. You know, do you look in the eye and see a team that's confident and ready and knows what they're doing? I think the answer is going to be yes. I think they're the better team here, unless they uncharacteristically turn the ball over multiple times or have special teams debacles. I think they're the better team, but just this clash of Alabama certainly has been the best program in college football for the last 15 years. You could argue it's the best program of all time, and you could argue Indiana's the worst program of all time that's had at least power conference affiliation. So bring it on there. I think I would put Texas Tech, Oregon second for the kind of the clash there of this Tech defense against, I think, a really good, typically fast Oregon offense. And yeah, to Brian's point, who's breaking through, who's getting to a semifinal and maybe saying, look, we're serious about winning a national title for the first time. And then I would go Miami, Ohio State third. And I would go Georgia, Mississippi fourth for the reasons you guys delineated there that Brian, it's a rematch and it is SEC against SEC. There's just not a lot of freshness there. There's some because there's a different coach for the Rebels than there was the first time, but I would put that one fourth. And then Miami and Ohio State I think is very interesting to me. I hope it's a close game. We'll see, and we'll get to that here in a minute,
Pat. But we saw Miami Ohio State already 2003, right?
We did. It was a while ago. Okay. But you know, the and yes, the penalty flag that will live forever in the minds of Miami fans, that's for sure. You don't have to go far around Miami fans for somebody to bring that one up. But all right, ranking in order of competitiveness. Brian, what's going to be the most exciting or tightly played game? And then give me first through last.
Well, I think Texas Tech, Oregon, just you look at the line, it's only 2.5 for the Red Raiders there. And so I think that would match what your kind of impressions of that Orange Bowl are going to be in terms of two very good defenses, two offenses that have a lot of skill position talent. Everybody loves both quarterbacks. So I think in terms of competitiveness, everybody kind of circles that Orange Bowl and says Texas Tech, Oregon. And I would tend to agree with that as the most competitive game, at least of these quarterfinals. I think Miami, Ohio State would probably be second. And I think that maybe that's just kind of leaning into the name brand, but these teams have some incredible playmakers on both sides. And yes, the defenses are excellent. I do expect this to be a bit of a low scoring affair, but you got Malachi Toney, you got so many weapons there, on the Ohio State offense as well. Like this is a team that, really a game that both teams can put up points and really, I think make that very competitive into the fourth quarter. Alabama, Indiana, I don't think that's going to be competitive at all. I think we'll see, everybody's focused so much on those name brands. But if we actually look at what these teams have done this season, Indiana should more than cover that 7 that is there and really run Alabama off the field. And I think that's a team where Alabama has self-destructed at times. I think you look at what Indiana is able to do, how crisply they've been able to execute a lot of times. I think that might be not as close as a Rose Bowl as we would anticipate, given the two teams on those side of those helmets. And then, Ole Miss, Georgia, I know the line is a little bit closer than it was. But again, I've seen these two teams. Georgia was the superior team, although Ole Miss really had had their way with those 5 consecutive scoring drives to open that game there in Athens. I'm very, very intrigued in terms of Georgia. Is this the game where they kind of put their stamp on things and say, hey, not only are we capable, not only are we ready to win the national title this year, but this is kind of a statement of intent game, I think, for Kirby Smart and this program, because they understand what happened last year against Notre Dame in this very same game. I think they're going to come out fired up, and I would anticipate that being the least competitive of these 4 quarterfinals.
Wow. Well, I kind of hesitate to get into specifics since we're going to pick these games, but if we're going to talk about just from a competitive level, I think all 4 of them are going to be close. I don't buy the blowout idea. And I'll get more specific as we get into the games, but I think there are a lot of reasons these games could be close. Could there be a blowout? Sure, of course, I guess. But, for example, Pat, you brought up a point. You're going to look at the IU players later this morning and try to get a sense of where they are. Is there sort of this sense of awe? Have they finally woken up and said, oh, my God, we're at the Rose Bowl. We're playing Alabama, and we're favored. I'm really interested in how that part of the equation unfolds, and we're not going to know that until they actually get that game going. X's and O's, yeah. IU should be the least competitive game against Bama, but I'm not so sure. So I'm going to take the position that I think all 4 of these games are going to be closer than we think they are.
Interesting. I'm least confident in Miami Ohio State being close. I think Ohio State is going to have its way in that game. Carson Beck's got to play better than he did against Texas A&M. I mean, he was a high-priced handoff guy in that game. He ended up with 103 yards passing, and that's giving him, 23 yards on a shovel pass to Malachi Toney. Going around the end for the winning touchdown. Their passing game was non-existent, and I just don't think you can count on Mark Fletcher carrying the offense against the Ohio State defense. The Ohio State defense, to me, is probably the best unit of any unit in the playoffs at this point, and if they come back, If Ohio State comes back with the same mentality this year that they did last year after their loss to Michigan, look out. I think that one could get potentially a little bit out of hand. I think the rest of them, I'm with you, Gene, that they should be competitive. I'm pretty confident that Indiana's the better team if Indiana shows up and plays to its capability there. And Mississippi, Georgia should be interesting. Could be back and forth. We'll see, Brian. You know, to your point, if Georgia's ready to flex, maybe they already did. They flexed in the SEC championship game. But if the flex continues, that may look a little bit messy. But I'm all for Lane Kiffin getting more bonus money from LSU after Governor Landry told us how ridiculous contracts are. That's the most ridiculous thing in a contract I've ever seen.
But Landry's in Greenland now.
Yeah.
Where'd that get him?
Yeah. Great point.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Okay, let's go ahead and pick the games. Updated standings. This is noteworthy, gentlemen. I did mention that I was 5-0 in our last picks. I don't know whether you remember, but I figured I better mention that again.
Yeah. What's the overall record though?
We're getting to that. The overall record, Brian, comfortable lead, 43-39. I have surpassed Gino for second at 40-42. Gene, 40-43 with the bear pick, keeping you within a half game.
Why do you always say that as if that's a negative? The bear pick really should count for more, if you ask me.
Bear pick, the fact that the bear pick counts.
That was your idea, not mine.
I would say. I acknowledged, you know. Be proud of your bear pick. Keep that. Nobody can take that away from you, ever. So, all right, let's pick the games here. And producer Kent will keep track of who's picking what. Miami getting 9.5 against Ohio State. Brian Fisher is covering this game in Jerry World. Where are you going, Brian?
Give me the Buckeyes in this one. You know, I think you look at that line, and it's kind of like almost begging you to take Miami at this point. You think, oh, that's a lot of points. Obviously, Miami, they have those weapons. They have Malachi Toney. You mentioned Mark Fletcher there. I think Carson Beck, it's funny. He was talking a little bit about the concern that you had there in that Texas A&M game. He actually went to the offensive coordinator and said, hey, we got to keep running duo at the Aggies, and we're going to run it down their throat. So he actually begged them to kind of take the ball out of his hands, which was an interesting thing there in that matchup in the first round. But I just think this is a late score. By Jeremiah Smith, Carnell Tate looks like he's healthy. There's just too many weapons on that Buckeyes team that I think in the second half they're able to kind of pull away in this one. And I think they will keep Miami down in terms of that offense. That just so many the mismatches, the ability that they have with Matt Patricia to change things up. Give me Ohio State to cover the 9.5.
I'll take that 9.5. And I'll take it for several reasons. One, you guys kind of forget it was really windy that day at A&M, and that really affected the passing games. And Carson Beck actually has his completion rate has been really respectable, above respectable, in the latter part of this season. But the reason I'm taking Miami to keep it close is I have faith in that D-line for the Hurricanes. And the one sort of weakness, if you can call it that, of Julian Sain is when he gets pressured, he's not as effective. And I think Miami's D-line can pressure him. And when Sain gets affected, well, that affects Tate and Jeremiah Smith. And those are the two guys that are really the difference makers. So I think Miami showed me something going on the road, beating A&M at their place, doing it in tough conditions. And I don't think they're going to be intimidated by Ohio State. I think they'll at least keep it within the range of the 9.5. And I would remind you back in 2003 that Miami was a double-digit favorite going into that game, and Ohio State won that game, obviously. So what do they have to do with each other? Nothing other than a reminder of, you know, big spreads don't necessarily mean anything between two big brands like this.
Yeah, I mean, that was a shocking result, frankly, that Ohio State was in the game and then won the game, because everybody thought Miami was unbeatable at that point. Neither of these teams are unbeatable, in my opinion, but I'm taking the Buckeyes here. I think defensively they are going to make it very difficult for Beck to find open receivers. And the way the secondary flies up, especially Caleb Downs and tackles, I think Mark Fletcher's going to have a hard time getting loose. Probably a lower scoring game, but I think Ohio State, Gene, you make a good point that the defensive line is going to be an issue for Ohio State to block, and that's why I think you might see more quick game passing from them. They love to take the deep shots because Sankin throws a wonderful deep ball, and they've got fast guys who can get open deep, but I wouldn't be shocked if they at least start out with a lot of quick game stuff to the outsides, to Smith and to Tate, and see if they can break a few plays there. And then you pick your spots for the deep shots. But I'm going with the Buckeyes. Gino, Texas Tech, Oregon, Red Raiders getting 2.5 in Miami Gardens. Where you go?
What does Oregon do really well? They run the ball. What does Texas Tech do extraordinarily well? They stop teams from running the ball. Again, I'm rolling the bones on a defensive line, this time Texas Tech's defensive line. I really like Oregon, but the 2.5 is just too much for me to turn down. I'll take the Red Raiders and the points.
I'm going to follow you up and take the Red Raiders as well. You know, I think you mentioned that defensive line for Texas Tech, and, you know, look at some of the teams that Oregon has played. You know, I think when, you know, you could get a hand in Dante Moore's face, you know, this year, Indiana did it a little bit. You saw Penn State do it a little bit in their game. You saw, you know, Iowa do it as well. So I think that's going to be a big question mark. And I think as well respected as the Ducks offensive line, I don't know if they've really faced, you know, four guys coming at them like Texas Tech can bring it. I'm a little concerned about the Red Raiders scoring in the red zone. That seems to be their biggest Achilles heel this year. So I think that's probably cause for concern there in the Orange Bowl. But you know what? I think Texas Tech, they want to prove a lot of people wrong in this game. And against an Oregon team, against Dan Lanning, who understands these environments, these big games, I think, you know, Texas Tech can pull off a shocker and cover that 2.5 for sure.
I'll take the Ducks here. I did. My thinking is Texas Tech red zone offense not very good, and Baron Morton just inconsistent. And he's going to serve up a pass or two potentially that Oregon can pick off, maybe take the to the house. Dante Moore, Texas Tech gets after the passer, and Dante Moore can be unsettled there. But the Oregon offensive line's good. They've only allowed 14 sacks this year. He can escape if he wants to and run too. So I think he can. They can find ways to not have the defensive line dominate for Texas Tech. So I'm taking the Ducks there. My game, Rose Bowl, Alabama getting 7 against Indiana. We've already noted this, the historic weirdness of this. But from an actual play standpoint, yeah, I like the Hoosiers here. I don't think it's going to be a blowout, but I think Indiana can win and cover. Omar Cooper's back, which gives them 3 extraordinary receivers. Well, you got Elijah Surratt, Cooper's excellent, and then the emergence of Charlie Becker, the sophomore, big and fast, makes tough catches. So, my man Mendoza is going to have plenty of guys to throw to. If they can get the running game cracked open a little bit, that could be another advantage. Alabama cannot run the ball. I don't expect them to have much success doing that. So I'm taking the Hoosiers to come out of the Rose Bowl for the first time in their history as winners.
You know, Kurt Cignetti has been sitting in that recliner of his. He's got that famous recliner there at his, you know, just watching film. And man, if he understands the moment, right? You know, and Pat, I'm sure you're going to talk with him here in just a little bit, but like he understands how big this can be. Not only Indiana in the Rose Bowl period, but like beating Alabama and beating them convincingly to understand the sport. I think he's going to have a few things saved up. I think just in terms of the matchup itself, I think Indiana's convincingly the better team. Alabama, especially in the second half of the season, you know, and I think that first round game where they almost handed it by Oklahoma, just in terms of the mistakes that they were able to capitalize on, I don't think Indiana's going to make those mistakes. And so give me the Hoosiers, not only to cover the 7, I think this is going to be a statement of intent there for Kurt Cignetti against one of his former teams that he used to coach with.
I've sat here and tried to figure out scenarios where Bama could somehow spring the upset. And I just keep on coming back to, as you said, Pat, the lack of a running game for Bama, the lack of consistency from Bama's offensive line. What in the world is going on with Ryan Williams? Those things keep on percolating. But then I just start, I don't want to get, you know, mesmerized by the crimson helmets and the number on the side and it's Bama. But I just wonder if Indiana wakes up that day and says, holy crap, we're in the Rose Bowl and we're favored. We're supposed to beat Alabama. Kalen DeBoer has shown a real talent for beating really tough teams. And this Bama team showed me something against Oklahoma, down 17 to nothing. If they get down 17 to nothing to Indiana, no, they're not winning. But I don't think they're going to get down 17-0 to Indiana. I just think there's something that Indiana's going to have another maybe Penn State moment or struggle Iowa moment or just have to really fight their way through something enough where Bama can keep it within the spread. So I think Indiana wins the game, but I think Bama keeps it close enough. I'll take Bama and the points.
All right. Good for diversity's sake here. And then the last game, the Sugar Bowl, which Brian will also be at. He's going to do double duty. New Year's night, New Orleans, Ole Miss getting 6.5 versus the Bulldogs. What do you think, Brian?
You know, in that first meeting, I thought it was maybe one of Lane Kiffin's best games that he called. You know, he had an answer for every third down. You know, he had plays drawn up. Trinidad Chambliss was able to scramble and create things with his legs. And that's a good reason why, you know, they did score those 5 straight touchdowns to open the game. But Lane Kiffin is not going to be there. He's not going to be calling the plays. And I think as good a job as Charlie Weiss did in these type of games against Kirby Smart and Glenn Schumann and that defense that the Bulldogs have, which has really come on in the second half of the season, really since that second half of the Ole Miss game, I think Georgia not only ends up covering the 6.5, but again, they make a statement here in this game that says, not only are we for real, we are one of the true national title contenders this year under Kirby Smart. So they get the job done there in the Sugar Bowl.
Pat, I'm sure you're going to write about this. Just peel back real quick on the Rose Bowl. 100-year anniversary of Bama playing in its very first Rose Bowl. And this is the first time Indiana and Bama have ever played each other. You would have thought somewhere they would have played along the line, but very first game. But getting back to this game, there are a lot of moving parts with Ole Miss. And it was fine against Tulane. They were playing at home. It's Tulane, heavily favored, a lot of emotion. But Georgia is not Tulane. And Georgia's defense has gotten better and better as the season's gone on. And it really kind of started after that Ole Miss game. But I'm going to take, I'm going back and forth, Pat. I'm going to take the dogs. I'm going to take the underdogs.
Yep.
I'm going to take Ole Miss and the points again for no other reason than to be different than Brian on this. But
he's just trying to climb out of the hole.
I'm trying to do that too. And I'm also trying to come up with some more bear picks if we can squeeze those in before. I'm going to take Ole Miss again just to keep it close. I think that offense is good enough to do that. I think rematches There are no guarantees that Georgia is going to play as well as it did in that fourth quarter, where it basically played a perfect quarter. And I think Ole Miss can fix a few things and keep it close.
The bear can no longer help you. We've established that. So, but I'm actually with you on this. I think Ole Miss at least can make it a field goal game. We'll see where Kiwon Lacy stands at.
He's probable right now, right?
I think he's probable. Yeah, I think it was shoulder banged up in that game against Tulane. But I do think the Ole Miss has the talent to hang in this game, and Kirby Smart is a great coach, and he wins a lot of games. There are times he's got a little Saban in him, and this is not a bad thing at all. But you get ahead, you stay ahead, and you win. You don't necessarily just push the foot on the throttle. You shorten the game at the end, and you just win. You don't necessarily win by 21. You win by maybe 5, 4, 3, whatever. So I'm going to say I'm taking the dogs in that. I'm sorry, I'm taking the Rebels to cover, the dogs to win. So. All right, there's our picks. Take them to the bank, everybody. Cannot lose with us.
Well, with you.
Yeah.
5-0.
Well, we thought the coaching carousel had perhaps stopped coming into mid to late December, but that's never the case in this day and age. We had two major updates last week. Marcus Freeman said no to the NFL and is staying at Notre Dame. And Michigan lucked into Kyle Whittingham. Let's discuss them both. I think we can all agree that keeping Freeman is huge for Notre Dame. That is, you know, I think if I look and see three guys that haven't won a national title that can and presumably will, it's Freeman, it's Dan Lanning, and it's Kurt Cignetti. And I think they're positioned well at their respective schools right now to take a run at it. And so that's where I think Freeman staying there and the continuity of that with a very young defense this year. They bring back, you know, most of those guys. They bring back a quarterback. It's this first time in Freeman's head coaching tenure he's going to have the same quarterback year over year. I think that it lines up for them to have a really, really good season next year, even without Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price. And obviously they'll lose a couple other guys too to the NFL. So, but I think this is big just for Notre Dame to have an incredibly talented coach, recruiter, motivator, all those things, retaining him. Gino, but I want to ask you your thoughts. What is the timeline on Marcus Freeman delivering a national title at Notre Dame? A year? 5 years? Never?
Well, Pat, I ran the algorithms earlier this morning, and they came up with a definitive, I don't know. I mean, who knows that sort of thing?
You're a big analytics guy.
I can't answer that question. I mean, if you tell me the NFL isn't going to make another run at Freeman next year or 2 years from now.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, if he stays there, he's absolutely good enough to lead a program to a national championship. And if you look at next year's schedule, and I don't want to get you riled up about this, Pat, but if you look at next year's schedule with no USC on it, what do they get? They get Miami and South Bend, SMU at South Bend, and they're on the road against BYU, and the rest of it I don't think isn't anything Notre Dame can't handle. I think Freeman's a remarkable coach, and I'm not stunned that he didn't leave for the NFL. Given how this season ended, I think it would have been very un-Freeman-like for him to leave, given that they made such a stink about not being selected for the playoff, given that they ditched a bowl game invitation. I think it would have been a really bad look for Marcus Freeman to bail on Notre Dame. So it doesn't surprise me that he stayed, but it won't surprise me if the NFL makes another run at him. But if he stays, for all the reasons you just mentioned, he's definitely good enough to lead that program to a national title.
I agree completely. You know, I think he is, you know, you mentioned that short list, Pat. I mean, I think he's right there. I mean, of all the coaches, you know, where things are setting up for him to make a run at a national title, you know, from the roster building, you know, he's stacking those recruiting classes, class after class. They're landing transfers, you know. That was obviously a big thing about Notre Dame. They were not able to take some of the guys that they wanted. He's kind of loosened up the administration to where he can get some guys into school that he needs to kind of get over the hump. And, you know, in terms of resources, you know, and they are providing everything that, you know, you need to win a national title there. And so, you know, this is a well-oiled machine there in South Bend. He has things humming. He's charismatic. He understands the game in terms of, you know, the marketing of the program. He's obviously a great defensive mind. He's putting together some great defenses. So, everything is lining up for in the next really 2 to 3 years. Here is a window for Notre Dame to not only to win it all, but really keep this momentum going from these last couple of years and build off of what they've done these late games under Marcus Freeman. If he can get over some of those losses, certainly that you know have been a bit inexplicable in terms of how they've found their way from a winning position into a losing position. That's probably the only thing that you could probably hold against Marcus Freeman, but he's pushing all the right buttons right now. It wouldn't be surprising at all within the next, say, 5 years if Notre Dame ends up winning a national title, which is crazy to think given how few of them that I've ended up seeing in my lifetime here from the Irish. You know, it is a testament to the job that he has done as a first-time head coach. You got to remember that too. I mean, this is taking over one of the biggest jobs in the sport, and he's doing it. Yes, he's eased into it at this point, but he was a first-time head coach, and so had to learn on the job. And I think he's overcome a lot of that, and now he's in a great position there with the Irish to possibly get over the hump and make it not only to the ultimate mountaintop, but put Notre Dame back where certainly their fans think that program belongs.
Yep. The algorithm, Gene, is 3.7 years.
Got it.
So
okay.
I've consulted.
You rounded up.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Win national. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Give him 4. But good point, Brian, too, about being able to get in transfers now. Notre Dame has relaxed some of their famously rigorous academic standards. And one of the reasons, though, the Notre Dame administration likes working with Marcus Freeman. It did not like working with Brian Kelly. Brian Kelly was a hard guy to work with. Freeman has diplomacy, has some charm, knows maybe that I don't need to push every minute of every day for something. And I think that goes a long way when you have an administration that actually wants to work with you at a place like Notre Dame. The old alignment, as coaches like to say. Following up off of that, it's basically a two-man debate over the best college football coach under the age of 40, in my opinion. Maybe you guys got somebody else, but Marcus Freeman, Dan Lanning are both 39. Both have ridiculous records to this point. Freeman's 43-12. Lanning is 47-7. Brian, which one's going to win a national championship first?
Well, obviously, Dan Lanning has a
better
chance this year.
Put
you know, the better coach is more interesting because, you know, I would take either one of them. If I had to hire either, you know, for running my program, I think just the way that especially Dan Lanning communicates with his team, you know, he thinks the bigger picture, but also understands, hey, this week I've got to push this button. And I think he's great at tailoring the message to these guys. He gets them fired up. He's got, he's got the pregame speeches down. Especially some of those that he's allowed the cameras in very strategically over the years. You mentioned also, like, is there a third guy? You know, the amount of coaches under 40 is a surprisingly small list compared to what I, at least in my mind, I thought it was. The only other guy I could maybe throw on there to compete with either of these two guys is maybe a Dan Lanning protege in Kenny Dillingham. You know, I think he did a terrific job, obviously, last year with Arizona State, getting them to the playoff, getting them on the brink of the doorstep there against Texas. And you know, I think even with the injuries, with what he had to go through this year with the Sun Devils, he showed some coaching chops this year to finish the season as strong as they did, given how many players, especially key players, were missing. So I would kind of put him as maybe in third place. But give me Dan Lanning a little bit. I think he's kind of tapped into what you need. And obviously, he's got a great chance this year. I think that Oregon team, even though I picked Texas Tech to cover that number earlier in the Orange Bowl, this team with the Ducks, you can definitely see a path to where they can win a national title this year with all that they have, especially if Dante Moore kind of lives up to the hype and looks like that first-round quarterback that a lot of NFL scouts think he is.
Ryan beat me to it. I'd written down Kenny Dillingham also. That's a no-brainer. He's 35 years old, and I think you could argue maybe he's done more with less than Lanning and Marcus Freeman. But if we're keeping it between Lanning and Freeman, I would probably take Lanning right now. I think they're both destined. Both those guys are destined for the NFL if that's something that they want. I think they're NFL kinds of coaches. But if they love the college game, they're built for that too. I think Lanning has kind of a tougher job in a way than Notre Dame, partly because Notre Dame, as you said, Pat, has kind of loosened it up a little bit as far as the transfer situation. Notre Dame's more centrally located geographically. Notre Dame has its own network. Notre Dame is able to kind of, as we've seen, create its own schedule, kind of an advantageous way. And Notre Dame now has a guaranteed path to the CFP if they finish in the top 12 moving forward. So whereas Oregon, every time they head east, it's a long trip. And Oregon is geographically kind of out there. And Oregon is kind of at the mercy of the schedule makers of the Big Ten. I think Lanning in some ways has it a little tougher than Freeman, but I'll take either one of them and I'll be fine with it. And I don't even think the argument is which one of them is best coach under 40. I think they stand up who's the best coach under 50, 60, 70. I mean, they're that good. So there's no wrong answers on this one to me.
Yeah, I think probably the only three people I would take ahead of them right now are Kirby Smart, Ryan Day, and Kurt Cignetti.
That's fair.
Period, of any age. So they're both excellent, for sure. This is today, before these quarterfinals, I'll say Marcus Freeman, based on what the playoff run they made last year. Now, if Dan Lanning turns it around and they make that kind of run they're playing a national championship game, I'm changing my mind probably. But that's the one thing we just haven't seen from Lanning yet at Oregon is a legitimate run at a national championship. They had that. I mean, I was at the game. It was an unbelievably shocking faceplant against Ohio State. I mean, Ohio State was a wagon, but still, they were undefeated, ranked number one, and they were behind 34-0 in the second quarter. It was they could not have been worse in a huge spot. So go to Miami, beat Texas Tech. And I start changing my mind maybe a little bit on that. But again, yes, I would be happy to have either as the head coach of my favorite program.
Let me ask you here. I'm splitting hairs here, but what's more shocking, what happened with Oregon, Ohio State, or what happened with Notre Dame and Northern Illinois? there have just been moments, and it's part of the maturity growth as a coach with these young guys. There've been some inexplicable losses in NIU with Notre Dame, and then the two early season losses. And I know they were by a total of 4 points, and we've gone through all the reasons why it was close, but they did lose those early season games. So that is one little, thing in Marcus Freeman's resume in the last 2 years that, just kind of sticks out a little bit.
Yeah, got to start seasons better. That's the thing. They've had early losses. Northern Illinois, there was Marshall, and then there was the 0-2 start this year. Got to be ready on opening weekend and throughout those first few weeks. Another coach on the opposite end of the experience spectrum, 66-year-old Kyle Whittingham, now at Michigan. Nobody really saw that coming until there it was. That hire has received near unanimous rave reviews, but Gene Wojciechowski, is there a hater's counterpoint to be made here?
Well, I'm not a hater. I'm one of the people who are applauding the hire. But I got a text from a longtime college football writer. I'm not going to say the writer's name, but this person texted me and said, am I the only one who's not entirely convinced this is a hire that fits? And this person wasn't ripping the hire, but I brought up some interesting points. And the point was, Whittingham has been used to being sort of a CEO at Utah. And at Utah, it was his program. He sort of had this autonomy. It was kind of his world. And but when you go to Michigan, which is a very provincial place and has a history of being very Michiganish with its donors, with its athletic director, with its former players, with just sort of with its fans, it's a different, it's a very different vibe than what is at Utah. And how is Whittingham going to make that transition? And is there going to be any difficulty in making that transition? So I do think it's a very different kind of place for a lot of different reasons. And I also think that at Utah, you know, one of the things that he did a great job was developing players that weren't necessarily five-star, four-star guys. Well, now he's going to get those four-star and five-star guys, and that's a different breed of cat. And how is he going to be able to work with those kinds of players, more, you know, high-strung, temperamental, used to sort of being their own bosses? I think he'll be successful there. But I do think it's a fair question to ask, is this a so much of a different kind of world that he's entering that there might be some growing pains?
Kind of hate
seen good, yeah, a little bit. I mean, we've seen good coaches go to Michigan and fail. I mean, Rich Rodriguez is a perfect example. I mean, you look at what he did before getting to Ann Arbor and what he's done after. You know, you could say there's still a good coach in there with Rich Rod, and that place just ate him up. And so I think that would kind of be the cautionary tale if you are Kyle Whittingham. You're moving to the Big Ten. You know, it's not a league that he has a whole lot of experience in. Yes, the style-wise, it would tend to suit what he likes to do in terms of offense and defense, but you're playing a lot tougher competition than you were in the Pac-12 or the Big 12 now. So there's definitely a kind of a step up into the big leagues in terms of who you're going up against. And you look at some of those coaches that he's going to be going up against in the Big 10. I mean, you're going to end up facing a Ryan Day. You're going to face a Kirk Cignetti, not only just to get through them to get to Indianapolis for the Big 10 title game, but you know, to get those big wins that you're going to need to satisfy that fan base. And you know, just the short-term nature of this hire, you know, this does look a little bit like a bridge hire. Does that impact him in any way? Does that impact the program in any way in terms of the number of guys that he can get? You know, are high schoolers, you know, you mentioned those four and five stars coming out of high school. Are they going to avoid going to Michigan knowing that, you know what, Kyle Whittingham, he might have signed a five-year deal, but this looks like a three-year type of tenure just to kind of get them over the hump these next couple of years. So that would be the only thing against this, but I think he will do well there. He fits that. I think he's going to change the culture there in Schembechler Hall. I think it's just a great fit in terms of what he's going to do. I kind of wrote this a little bit. You know, I can't wait to see what he can do with resources. What can he do with a five-star quarterback? You know, we haven't seen that from a Kyle Whittingham coach team. So I think that's to me is the one thing that almost makes me excited to see what he's going to do there in Ann Arbor, because he's not had these resources. He's done more with less and been one of the best coaches in college football. What's he going to do with more now?
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys both make several valid points. It is very Michiganish, as Gene said, and there will be some adjustment. And these are two people that this is a person and an entity that are both used to doing things yep. their way. So where is the give that they can come together and say, you know what? All right, we got to do things a little bit differently to make this thing work. And it does look like a short-term hire, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, 5 years maximum, I would guess. We'll see, you know, is he ready to hit the ground running right away? certainly improved the culture in Schembechler Hall, the organization, everything. I mean, even from what I've heard going back, Jim Harbaugh did not run an organized program. He ran a great program, but it was not, there was an element of kind of day-to-day chaos with Jim that they somehow made work. And Sharon Moore wasn't, I don't think, as I guess, gifted at excelling amid chaos. This is not going to be a chaos organization with Kyle Whittingham. He doesn't tend to operate that way. I think they should be immediately very tough physically on both lines of scrimmage. You know, whatever players they have, I think they've got good players generally in those areas, but they'll perhaps be improved and be better. And then we'll see. Do you keep Bryce Underwood? Is Bryce Underwood going to be in an offense that's going to flourish? And so on from there. And then, yes, the recruiting piece is going to be absolutely vital to sell people that, yeah, come to Michigan and we're going to go beat Ohio State again. So a lot of intrigue, obviously, there. We're not hating on the hire. We're just asking some questions.
He gives them an instant identity. They're going to be a physical team. He's made that very clear. He gives them credibility. He gives them an integrity component that they sorely need right now, given some of the issues that Michigan football has had. So, you know, it's a good hire. I'm not concerned about 66 years old. I don't care. I mean, Cignetti's 64. I mean, are we saying 2 years is right. A huge, huge deal? I don't think so. But, you know, Brian and Pat, you both make a really interesting point. They gave him a 5-year deal. Is that for show or is he really going to be there 5 years?
Right. Yeah, well, and you're right. And I think I would bet that if Cignetti hadn't been so successful in his 60s, that this isn't one of those things Michigan would have looked and said, I mean, I think that helped him get this job.
The Cignetti effect.
All right. Yes, yeah. He's everywhere. Something else that I think the hater tag probably applies more accurately here. The transfer portal opens January 2nd. So, yeah, start preparing for the shocks, the plot twists, the hurt feelings, the dishonest salary numbers, and the cries that the end is near for college football. It's not, I promise you. But that doesn't mean that things can't be better. And I did find this quite funny that John Calipari is advocating for an NCAA rule, a one-time free transfer with every subsequent transfer being contingent on sitting out a year. This was already an NCAA rule, and the court swatted it down, and that's why we have the transfer superhighway that we do. I like the idea, but it's just not feasible. We've already been down this road legally. Unless appeal to the Supreme Court changed, that's not happening. So, gentlemen, if there's anything you would change about the portal, what would it be? Brian, you go first. Let's try to keep it relatively tight here.
Yeah, you know, it's before the season started, I did a story kind of on general managers, you know, in the sport. And Mark Pantone, the Ohio State GM, you know, had a good line in terms of, you know, we do things backward in college sports. You know, you look at the NFL and how they have, you know, organized, you know, you go free agency and then you have the draft. And then, you know, it's very orderly, you know, in terms of the process of assembling your roster. And college football, it's almost, you know, completely flipped. So if I was in charge, if I was the czar of college football or the commissioner, whatever you might want to term it, I would definitely move the transfer portal, if you will, just to the summer, you know, move it to the end of the semester, into that second semester. This is a 2-semester sport at this point. Move it to the end. Guys can still transfer. Yes, we could have, you know, OTAs in the summer. You know, if coaches are concerned about getting their guys in, learning the system, that sort of thing. We've seen Jake Retzlaff, you know, show up, you know, barely a couple weeks before the season start and lead his team to the playoffs. So it can be done with these guys moving around. So I'm not concerned about that. I would get rid of the, you know, the early signing period in December, which I think is just a complete mess and especially speeds up a lot of these hiring timelines. So move that back to your traditional February date so we can have some actual interest around signing day. I think if you do those two things, things will be a lot more orderly in terms of the assembling of these rosters.
So, Pat, are you saying that if my idea, Are the courts going to be involved if I throw out an idea? Judge 40, can you rule on that, depending on what?
I will be the Supreme Court Justice, here, right. Chief Justice, well, right here, right now.
I love the portal because it gives us things like, you know, Fernando Mendoza and Diego Pavia, and we can go down the list of success stories. But I also hate the portal because it guts rosters. It certainly doesn't help the academic progress of players. And I would hope there's still an academic component to college football. But if it's allowed, Judge 40, I would maybe explore the idea of players having to sign two-year contracts. That way, they'd get some sort of financial security, and coaches and programs would get some sort of roster certainty. And also, it might serve the idea of academic progress, too. And then also, if your coach left after you sign that two-year program, you're immediately allowed to cut bait and go wherever. You can stay if you want, but you can leave if you want also. Your ruling, sir.
You guys, my ruling, you know what? I'm in favor. I would pound a gavel right here and say okay. Approved. Enforceable two-year contracts. We've seen there's been a lot of contracts out there. The ability to enforce, or the willingness, I guess, to go to court and enforce contracts on guys that leave is where things tend to break down. But you're both abundantly wise here. I love Gene's idea, but also what Brian said is exactly what I was going to say, that move everything back. Move the portal to the spring so that it doesn't just overshadow the season in the fall and the plans for the season and the plans for next season. I think it would alleviate some of the hiring cycle stuff. And absolutely, I'm in favor of moving the signing day. I might move it back to March, you know. And I am sorry if you've got to make high school kids wait till March to sign a letter of intent. They can commit. But I just think the amount of pressure and stuff that college football tries to get done at the same time, my old podcast colleague Dan Wetzel said, it's like having free agency, the playoffs, hiring, like the NFL, if the NFL just decided to do everything, and the draft all in like a month, in from mid-December to mid-January, it's completely preposterous and ridiculous and causes a lot of problems. But speaking of preposterous and ridiculous, I did write a column that basically was like a podcast rant. So if people want to look for it, the dumbest things that happen in college sports in 2025, there have been a lot of them. It's been a dumb year. And I left the creation of this podcast off the list. Hopefully we're only moderately dumb, but there's so much else to choose from. I'm going to rip through this quickly, but then you guys give me what you guys think was the dumbest thing that has happened in college sports in 2025. Number 10, the governor of Louisiana becoming a meddling booster. Jeff Landry basically firing athletic director Scott Woodward, and phone calls to Lane Kiffin to make sure that he was happy as the LSU coach. Nico Iamaliava misplaying the market and leaving Tennessee for what he thought was going to be more money and ending up with less money on a worse team. Good move. The ACC tiebreaker that somehow left their best team out of the championship game, even though it had a record that was tied with the other teams, the second place team that made it. Bill Belichick, period. Maybe it gets better next year. I'm not saying it's over, but yikes. The do-over free agency in basketball, I'm not even going to go into that because that's a bit complicated, but it's stupid. Sharon Moore's program management, extremely dumb, did not work out well. Expanding the NCAA basketball tournament, that's an entire other podcast, and there will be one when they finally get around to doing that. Then believing that the House settlement and or Congress could provide guardrails. The naivete, I guess, of thinking that people were just going to all of a sudden play by the new rules. Good. the gambling legislation, this is actually my favorite thing, was when they said it was okay for athletes and coaches and staff to bet on pro sports. And they passed that rule at the exact same time that there's a federal investigation of corrupt gambling over college basketball. Then they had to walk
back. Was that wrong, Pat?
And then number one.
Was that wrong?
What's that?
Did they make a mistake there?
I think that was, okay. I think that was misguided. I'm going to say again, the optics of it were incredible and they just went right ahead with it. Like what's the problem? Incredible. Thank you, Greg Sankey, actually, for getting that, the ball rolling on rescinding that. And then number one is every single idea that Tony Petitti came up with as the commissioner of the Big Ten. I won't even go into him. I would like some proof that Tony Petitti actually likes college sports. So, gentlemen, that's my rant on the dumbness of college sports. What do you got? Give me one thing that has driven you nuts this year.
Well, I took Penn State and Texas to play in the national championship. That wasn't so bright. Penn State bumbling and stumbling around for a coach was entertaining. But I'm with you, Pat. First of all, I loved your column. I thought it was a great idea and really well executed. And I'm going to steal your number one. You know, I was not a fan of Kevin Warren when he was commissioner of the Big Ten. I thought he was way over his skis in that job. But I'm not sure Tony Petitti even knows how to put the skis on yet. It has been one tone-deaf idea after another, automatic qualifiers. Let's expand the playoffs to 148 teams. Let's have play-in games because that's what my TV partner would love to see happen. It just, to your point, everything he has suggested, and I didn't even mention the private capital, private equity ideas, everything he has suggested is more for an NFL model. And college football is not the NFL, at least not yet. And we'd like to keep it that way if it's okay with you, Tony.
Well, the only thing I'll add is, you know what, dumbness in this sport is a feature. It is not a bug. It is what we embrace. It is what we talk about. It is the reason this podcast exists. And it certainly gives us a lot of fodder over the years. So as crazy as it is, as hair-pulling, as gray-inducing as it can be for a lot of these commissioners, for a lot of these ADs, you know what? I will say that this has been going on for 30 years, and so there are dumb ideas every single year. This year was quite, you know, way up there in terms of the list that you had to pick for. I know, Pat, we contributed a couple of ideas, and you probably could have done 20 or 25 things if you really wanted to, but space consideration certainly limited you to 10. So I will concur on number one with Tony Petitti, and you know, where's the commissioner of common sense? He needs somebody in that room that can say this is not a good idea. Let's not put this out there, because man, the Big Ten they were leaders and legends in a certain kind of way this year, and that is not a good thing to say. But congrats, Tony Petitti, on at least winning something this year.
Hey, they may end up winning a third straight national title, so you know, maybe they don't even need him to like college sports to succeed. All right, guys, clearly this podcast is going long, but we've got to get one more topic in. Great. This, you put on your robe, justice robes here, and we need a ruling on a people's court ruling here from the New York Post, of course, from the New York Post, and from Florida, of course. A Florida man filed a lawsuit against Outback Steakhouse alleging that a handicapped toilet he used at one of the Sunshine State locations, quote, suddenly shattered and collapsed while he was using it. Michael Green, this is in Ocala, Florida. And like, I know the location. I have stayed at hotels off of this Ocala, Florida exit off I-75 when you're covering Florida and you can't get into Gainesville, can't get a hotel room. You end up sometimes in Ocala. So I know the location, but he was using the facilities there, and apparently the toilet collapsed, and he is alleging that the injuries suffered range from, quote, significant and permanent loss of an important bodily function to, quote, loss of capacity for the enjoyment of life. Justices, without knowing the actual specifics of this, and I don't think we really want to know the specifics, but does the man's lawsuit for $50,000 have any merit. Justice Wojciechowski, are you ruling in his favor or not?
Well, as soon as you begin a sentence with a Florida man, you know something bad is going to happen. Am I allowed to ask the weight of the person in question?
The man? You can ask. Unfortunately, it's not in the story.
So to me, that would be a key piece of information. You know what? If I were that restaurant chain, I would pay the $50,000 and get the heck out of there. $50,000 seems like a small amount of money to pay for making this thing, excuse the pun, go away. And I don't want to know what his specific bodily issues are.
No.
Ever.
No.
Well, Brian? Yeah, I agree completely, Gene. And you know, I think not only am I going to rule in favor of him, but I might treble those damages, because $50,000, given that list that you reeled off there, that seems a little bit low. If you're asking me, even at $150,000 for Outback, I think they can cover that tab, whether that's the franchise owner there or the larger corporation. So not only ruling in favor of the plaintiff there, but I will treble those damages at the very least.
I will say that a friend of ours within the profession, I was running this by him, said the onion might have bloomed a little too fast here. For
there it is, our first blooming onion joke.
Yeah. But no, I'm in my justice role. I case dismissed, thrown out. No way. You do not win this case. Outback, stay firm on this for this very reason. You just, unless it's an emergency, you don't do the sit down stuff out at a restaurant. That's a faux pas, to say the least. You do not inflict that on the other customers, and you don't put yourself at risk by going in to do that. So it's a stand up situation only. Get in, get out. Less time spent in a public bathroom, the better.
This podcast is in the crapper now, isn't it?
It completely is. Let's flush this episode right now. All right, guys.
Happy New Year
to everybody. Thanks for listening all year. Enjoy the quarterfinals. We'll be back next week to chop them up and talk about everything else dumb that's happening. Thanks for listening.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit LGUSA.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.